government tenant who paid rent of $517,000 a year. In September 2016, Artemis was partners in a venture to buy a building on the expensive Warren Parkway in Dallas. A federal government tenant was paying $453,000 a year in rent. Artemis is potentially only one of several Pritzker real estate companies with federal government contracts. Pritzker's commercial real estate holdings go well beyond Artemis, but they are largely held in obscure limited liability companies that are difficult to trace. It is impossible to know the full extent of the federal government leases from which Pritzker collects money. But it is not just about government leases. Pritzker's Artemis also acquired properties and did business with contractors to the Department of Commerce and with companies over which she had powerful regulatory authority. In October 2013, Artemis joined with a company called Onyx Equities to acquire corporate offices in Morristown, New Jersey. The Mount Kemble Corporate Center was a massive 230,000-square-foot building. 2.5 years later, the tech giant Avaya relocated its regional operations base into the building. Avaya, which has an Avaya Federal Solutions division, was and is a Department of Commerce contractor. It also does work with other government agencies. Some tenants of Pritzker-owned companies also received Department of Commerce contracts and money from Pritzker. In August 2013, Artemis bought an industrial space in Huntington Beach, California. The 102,000-square-foot building didn't sit empty for long. It was quietly announced that a 10-year lease, valued at $9.1 million, was inked with Dreesen Aircraft Interior Systems, Incorporated. Dreesen designs, builds, and markets high-quality galleys for commercial and private aircraft, and planned to occupy all of the space. Dreesen is a subsidiary of Zodiac Aerospace, a company with more than 20,000 employees. They had $3 billion in sales in 2012. Zodiac Aerospace is regulated by the U.S. Department of Commerce. The customer acknowledges that some of the products may be subject to export laws and regulations, such as laws and regulations issued by the U.S. Department of State International Traffic in Arms Regulations, or ITAR, U.S. Department of Commerce Export Administration Regulations, or EAR, or any other trade control regulations of any other country. Zodiac of North America, another subsidiary of Zodiac Aerospace, was awarded almost $800,000 in contracts by the Department of Commerce while Pritzker was Secretary of Commerce. Zodiac also did business with Commerce before Pritzker's appointment. On March 9, 2016, Zodiac Aerospace was picked by the Department of Commerce to participate in Obama's Tech Hire program. In March 2014, Pritzker's company Artemis took a stake in the construction of a $120 million office project on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C. The construction of the large glass building on North Capitol Street, just blocks from the U.S. Capitol building, was described by the Washington Business Journal as a speculative office development and a risky venture. They had no pre-construction leasing commitments from tenants. But when the project was nearing completion in 2015, it was announced that despite the gamble of building the project, they had two new tenants. They just happened to be the National League of Cities and the National Association of Counties. Both lobbying organizations dealt extensively with the Department of Commerce, which handed out grants and cash to cities and municipalities around the country. The National Association of Counties listed as a top legislative priority in 2015 the Department of Commerce grant program. The new tenant at the Pritzker property was also involved in joint forums held by the National League of Cities and the Department of Commerce. Artemis went so far as to hire the federal government's top real estate executive to come work for them during her tenure. In March 2015, Pritzker's Artemis hired the head of the General Services Administration, or GSA, to come and work at the company. Dan Tangerlini left the GSA, where he managed real estate for the federal government, and took a job as the COO at Artemis Real Estate Partners. The Washington Post reported that Tangerlini has connections at nearly every level of government associated with real estate in Washington. The administrator of the GSA oversees the procurement of real estate, travel services, and technology for the federal government. Then there was the question of money flow and favors involving Pritzker's family members. On March 30, 2015, the Chicago-based Clean Energy Trust, which supports clean energy startups through business development, won a piece of the $10 million in grants given by the U.S. Department of Commerce. The trust was the only Chicago organization to receive federal money, and it planned to use the money for marketing, fundraising, and staff. The co-chair of the Clean Energy Trust is Penny Pritzker's cousin, Nick Pritzker, of whom she spoke so fondly from her childhood. 12. Trump Princelings. Donald Trump has promised to drain the swamp. Among the challenges he may face are potential conflicts of interest and princeling-style deals involving foreign entities and his children. Donald Trump and his family arrived at the White House with countless business and personal relationships around the world, some going back decades. By one account, there were at least 111 Trump companies that had deals in at least 18 different countries, including projects in Saudi Arabia, Indonesia, India, and Panama. His contentious election to the White House has brought out apocalyptic predictions from his political opponents, and some concerns even from allies who would have him avoid the kind of ethical landmines that could weaken and distract his administration. In an effort to steer clear of conflicts of interest during his presidency, President-elect Donald Trump had said that his hundreds of businesses would be placed in a trust managed by his adult sons. As we have seen in previous chapters, foreign entities and even some U.S. corporations see the children and other family members of powerful American politicians as useful channels for monetary influence. As I said in December 2016, before Trump took office, foreign entities who are going to try to curry favor or get leverage over an American president often do it by trying to strike a sweetheart deal with a family member, often with one of the kids. That's my concern. You're going to have Bahrain or Saudi Arabia or Russia or Kazakhstan or some foreign power that wants something from Donald Trump is going to offer and give a sweetheart deal to one of the kids. The kids will take it, and now, suddenly, there is some sense of either obligation or leverage or some form of embarrassment that can be used against the president. Or the Trump kids might not just be offered a deal. They might seek them out like the Biden and Kerry families did during the Obama administration. I also expressed concerns about Trump's continued involvement with his companies in a Washington Post op-ed piece I co-wrote with Obama's ethics czar, Norm Eisen. Both the Kushners and the Trumps operate in the world of real estate, which is highly political. Particularly overseas, foreign governments and oligarchs can make or break large real estate deals. From Russia to China to Kazakhstan, zoning, permits, and financing for a major hotel or golf course require the help and blessing of political figures. So how might such a deal go down in a Trump administration? As of this writing, the Trump administration has been in office for 9 months. Where do the possible conflicts and vulnerabilities lie? How do we hold the kids to account? Where might we have foreign or American entities employ the princelings model to curry favor with the new administration? Studying the business ties of Trump and his children is a first step toward answering these questions. We will begin with Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump, because they have taken positions in the West Wing influencing and shaping American policy. Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump. Jared Kushner married into the Trump family from a real estate empire of his own. His father, Charles Kushner, and other family members developed a real estate empire primarily focused in New Jersey, including apartment buildings and commercial real estate. The year after Jared graduated from Harvard in 2003, Charles was arrested on charges of tax evasion, illegal campaign donations, and witness tampering. The U.S. attorney leading the prosecution at the time was Chris Christie, who would later go on to be governor of New Jersey and serve in the Trump administration as the anti-drug czar. On March 4, 2005, Charles Kushner was convicted and sentenced to 2 years in federal prison. 4 years later, in 2009, Jared's uncle, Richard Stottmeyer, who was married to Charles's sister and who helped run the real estate empire, was sentenced to 3 years in federal prison for illegally writing off millions of dollars in charitable and political donations on company taxes. After his father went to prison, Jared assumed additional responsibilities for Kushner companies. In January 2007, the same year that he met Ivanka, he made his largest bet, one that would come back to haunt him and would create a major source of financial vulnerability for the family. The real estate market was on the downturn after the massive boom that had dominated for almost a decade when Jared made an ambitious move. Using loans, he bought the 666 Fifth Avenue building in New York. The aluminum-jacketed office tower covers the whole block between 52nd and 53rd Streets in Midtown Manhattan, near the famous Rockefeller Center. Kushner companies seriously overpaid for the property. The Kushners paid $1,200 a square foot, twice the previous record of $600. As the real estate publication The Real Deal put it, the transaction was the priciest single building purchase in U.S. history. The Kushners did not put a lot down on the deal, financing the purchase with a $1.2 billion loan from Barclays Capital and an additional $535 million in short-term debt. They were heavily leveraged. Later in 2007, to offset the debt, Kushner Companies sold its entire portfolio of rental apartments for about $1.9 billion to AIG and Morgan Properties. The following year, Jared Kushner took the helm as CEO of Kushner Companies. When the stock market crashed in September 2008, the cash flow from 666 was not enough to cover the debt they still owed to the lenders. Jared had expected to make $120 million annually in rent. The property was bringing in $30 million a year with a 30% vacancy. To help cover the deficit, Jared sold the retail condominium portion of the property to the Carlyle Group and Crown Acquisitions for $525 million. But the move was simply buying time. By 2011, the Kushner Companies faced a default deadline on the property. The following year, Vornado Realty Trust agreed to a $707 million deal for the retail portion of the property. Jared Kushner's company remains highly leveraged on the property. The interest-only mortgage is due in February 2019. What makes Kushner's situation precarious is not simply the financial vulnerability of his company, but the fact that once his father-in-law was elected, Kushner sought and received a senior position in the White House. He has become one of the president's closest advisors. He has at various times described his role as a liaison to the business community, while also positioning himself as someone involved in Middle East policy. When President Trump welcomed Chinese President Xi Jinping to his Palm Beach club Mar-a-Lago, Beijing used Jared Kushner as the back channel as a means of communication. Since Kissinger, the Chinese have been infatuated with gaining and maintaining access to the White House, Evan S. Medeiros, an Obama administration senior director for Asia, told the New York Times. Having access to the president's family and somebody they see as a princeling is even better. According to the South China Morning Post, Chinese diplomats see the strategic use of the Kushner channel as a good avenue to pursue better relations. As the paper puts it, it is well known in Washington diplomatic circles that Sui Tiankai, the Chinese ambassador to the U.S., has maintained close relations with Kushner and Ivanka Trump since Trump took office. The Chinese government has already tried to court the Trumps through the goodwill of small benefits. In March 2017, the Chinese government finally granted the family 38 trademarks for various Trump projects after more than a decade of refusing to approve them. On the day that President Xi had dinner at Mar-a-Lago, China approved Ivanka's company request to sell handbags, jewelry, and spa services in China. Ivanka Trump enjoys deep commercial ties with politically connected Chinese companies. Between 2013 and 2015, her company had clothes produced by a company owned by the Chinese government. Since her father was elected president, she has pledged to avoid business with state-owned companies. But tracking those ties is not always easy. Ivanka Trump shoes are also produced annually by a company called Huajian Group in China's Jiangxi province. The company was founded in 1984 by a former PLA officer named Zhang Haorong, who today is deeply connected to the Chinese Communist Party power structure. He's a member of the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference, an exclusive high-level advisory body for the party. These relationships hardly equate with the large private equity deals and real estate partnerships that Biden and Kerry family and allies struck with the Chinese, but we are still on the front end of the Trump administration. The Chinese and other governments will certainly be looking for ways to offer the Trumps and Kushners other favors and deals. Even more problematically, the Kushner family appears to be seeking lucrative business deals given some financial icebergs that are on the horizon. Jared Kushner needs an infusion of cash or he risks losing the 666 building. During his father-in-law's campaign and since he entered the White House, Kushner has sought deals with foreign entities to help him out with the property. We can expect that those from whom he is seeking money will seek policy favors in return. Jared Kushner negotiated a tentative deal with China's Anbang Insurance Company, a financial institution in China headquartered in Beijing and one of China's most politically connected companies, according to the Financial Times. The chairman of the Anbang Company, Wu Xiaohui, was married to the granddaughter of Deng Xiaoping, once the paramount leader of China. Kushner's negotiations with Anbang took place both before and after Trump was elected president. Anbang withdrew from the negotiations when the deal was exposed by the New York Times and questions were raised about conflicts of interest. A few months later, Wu Xiaohui was detained by Chinese authorities. Kushner and his father Charles have also sought a $500 million deal from a billionaire from the tiny Middle Eastern nation of Qatar. The nature of those discussions was highlighted by The Intercept, an investigative publication with a very solid track record of journalism. According to a report by The Intercept's Ben Walsh, Ryan Grimm, and Clayton Swisher, Sheikh Hamad bin Jassim Al Thani, known as HBJ for short, held extensive negotiations with both Kushners. Throughout 2015 and 2016, while a campaign was going on, Jared and his father negotiated directly with HBJ to refinance the 666 property. Those negotiations continued through the spring of 2017, after Trump occupied the White House and Jared had joined him as a senior advisor. HBJ is the former prime minister of Qatar and ran the country's sovereign wealth fund. A former emir of Qatar once said of him, "I may run this country, but he owns it." According to The Intercept, HBJ agreed to cough up a $500 million on the condition that the Kushners raise the additional funds needed to upgrade the property. Anbang was supposed to provide some of that funding before they pulled out. Then in the spring of 2017, the Trump administration supported an effort by Qatar's regional rivals, including Saudi Arabia, to isolate the tiny nation. Arguing that the country was supporting terrorism, and there was plenty of material to support that argument, the Trump administration backed efforts by Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Egypt, and Bahrain, blocked media outlets, and precipitated a diplomatic crisis in the region. Curiously, Kushner was fingered for backing the push against Qatar and reportedly delivered remarks written by the UAE ambassador to his father-in-law. During the presidential transition in December 2016, Kushner also held secret meetings with a Russian bank named Vnesholchonim Bank. The state-owned financial institution is close to Vladimir Putin, has played a role in a past espionage case, and has been under U.S. sanctions since 2014. Kushner met with Sergei Gorkov, the bank's chief executive and a graduate of the Russian Academy of the Federal Security Service, or FSB. The FSB is the domestic intelligence arm of the Russian government. Kushner claimed that the meeting was generally a diplomatic matter. Bank officials said that the meeting was with Kushner in his capacity as the head of the family's real estate business. In short, Kushner has met with a veritable United Nations of lenders since his father-in-law was elected president. All are either government-owned or deeply politically connected in their countries. Another area of concern? Jared Kushner's involvement with Thrive Capital, an investment fund run by his brother Josh. Unlike his older brother Jared, Josh Kushner appears to have little interest in politics. "Josh doesn't want a public profile," said one investor in Thrive, Darren Walker, president of the Ford Foundation. He assured us that he would remain focused on Thrive. Jared Kushner has served on the Thrive board since 2009. On his personal financial disclosure, he listed capital gains from Thrive entities of over $5 million in 2016. Thrive has invested in several businesses that could prove to be conflicts of interest. Among their holdings, OpenGov, a technology company that is providing tools for financial information on government spending. Transparency is a good thing. But are there actions that Jared Kushner could take in the Trump administration to benefit the company? Thrive is also heavily invested in Oscar Health, a health insurance company. The company was founded by Josh Kushner. Oscar is a health insurance company that employs technology, design, and data to humanize healthcare. Oscar Health, of course, stands to win or lose based on decisions made about reforming Obamacare. How deeply involved is Jared Kushner in shaping American healthcare policy? One of Trump's signature issues during the 2016 campaign was building a border wall with Mexico. An Israeli company with ties to both Kushner and the Trumps is hoping to get some of the substantial contracts for that massive construction project. Magal Security Systems is an Israeli security company that constructed a security fence in Gaza. Shortly after Trump was sworn into office, executives from the company arrived in the D.C. area for a security conference that involved the Department of Homeland Security and would no doubt include discussions on their barrier system. The day after Trump allowed that a security barrier such as theirs could all but stop illegal border crossings, shares in the company jumped 5.6%. The company's shares had already climbed nearly 50% since Trump's election in November. Who is behind Magal? The children of one of the company's former board members who, through various entities, is still a major stockholder at 44%, have purchased nearly $60 million in Trump condos. Kushner also has close financial ties to the Steinmetz family, an Israeli family that made their money in the international diamond trade. Benny Steinmetz is under investigation in the United States for allegedly bribing foreign officials in exchange for mining rights. Kushner and Benny's nephew, Roz Steinmetz, are partners on at least 15 properties in Manhattan and the Trump Bay Street project in New Jersey. These are investments that Jared Kushner disclosed, but there are serious questions about how accurate those disclosures were. Since he filed his financial disclosure in March 2017, he has amended the document an astonishing 39 times, adding 77 investments he previously omitted. Eric and Donald Trump Jr. Eric and Donald Trump Jr. chose not to join their father in the White House. Instead, their role has been to run the Trump family empire. Still, it cannot be overstated that foreign governments and businesses are going to be eager to grant favors to the Trump organization because they expect that it will help them with the president. Their expectations are certainly not grounded in America's best interest, and the appearance of such collusion is both demoralizing to American citizens and encouraging to corrupt players around the world. Even before he was elected, we saw this happen when President-elect Trump spoke with Argentina's president. A previously stalled Trump building project in the country was revived when the government granted the necessary building permits. The Argentine paper La Nación reported that Trump asked for them to authorize a building he's constructing in Buenos Aires. It wasn't just a geopolitical chat. Spokesmen for both presidents deny the subject came up, and in many ways it didn't need to. Foreign governments know that money talks. By helping American politicians and their families in the pocketbook, they are more likely to get a favorable outcome when they talk to them about other matters. Just weeks after Donald Trump was inaugurated, a Chinese businesswoman named Angela Chen, who also goes by the names Xiao Yan Chen and Chen Yu, bought a penthouse in Trump Park Avenue, a condo on Manhattan's Upper East Side, for $15.8 million. She purchased the property from Trump Park Avenue LLC, an entity controlled by the Trump Organization. So the deal effectively resulted in money in President Trump's pocket, or estate. Curiously, the penthouse was not on the market at the time and had no listing price. According to Jonathan Miller, a real estate appraiser in New York, Chen overpaid for the condo. In my view, the seller did a little better than what the market conditions would suggest. Besides the price, what made the deal a red flag was the buyer's ties with the Chinese government. Chen runs a firm called Global Alliance Associates, which describes itself as having developed a well-deserved reputation as a respected and sought-after advisor on establishing business relationships in China. Chen also chairs something called the China Arts Foundation, started by Deng Rong, the daughter of former Chinese leader Deng Xiaoping. Deng Rong served as the vice president of the China Association for International Friendly Contacts, or CAIFC, an affiliate of the Intelligence and Foreign Propaganda Division of the People's Liberation Army. CAIFC has been called a front for Chinese intelligence by academics and government experts. Its offices are reportedly located in a Beijing compound used by military units. Another pattern began shortly after Trump was elected. the governments of Bahrain and Azerbaijan held national and religious celebrations respectively at the Trump International Hotel, just blocks from the White House. Trump has wisely promised that once he was elected, any profits from such visits by foreign officials would be donated to federal coffers. This is great, but requires intense monitoring. There can be no doubt that these governments expect that by throwing business at the Trump family, they will get favorable treatment in return. As we have seen throughout this book, in many foreign regimes, this is how political business is done. Trump, as U.S. president, and his children as the first family, must maintain the diplomatic standard that this is not how political business is done in a constitutional republic. Like Kushner, the Trumps have financial vulnerabilities. They owe $300 million in loans to Deutsche Bank, the German financial behemoth that has run into trouble with the U.S. Department of Justice over its banking practices. The Trump Organization also owes hundreds of millions to the Bank of China for its real estate projects. For those keeping track, the Bank of China has already positioned itself well by partnering with the Bidens, placing the sister-in-law of the Senate Majority Leader on its board of directors, and now is a major lender to the President of the United States company. Biden and McConnell aside, the question for Trump is, how will these loans play out? Will the Trumps be pressured or encouraged by their bankers to carry out policies for their benefit? It is unclear at this point, and a game of vigilance. Some might argue that loans by themselves do not amount to much leverage. As John Maynard Keynes once said, if you owe your bank £100, you have a problem. But if you owe £1 million, it has. Still, if you have to refinance your loans, you might be offered favorable rates, with silk strings attached. In January 2017, President Trump's lawyers offered assurances to the American public that the Trump Organization would not pursue new deals overseas, but the family business has continued to move forward with projects that they had previously negotiated. So the Trump commercial empire continues to expand, even while he occupies the Oval Office. Two projects in Indonesia will bear the Trump name. The project partners include Hari Tanusudibyo, who goes by Harry Tano, and who has deep political ties in Indonesia. Tano attended Trump's presidential inauguration as a guest of the Trump Organization. He recorded the event on Instagram with pictures of himself with Don Jr. and Eric. Again, vigilance will be required by the first family to maintain goodwill without cultivating foreign expectations. A new Trump office building and residential development in India is also underway. The Trump Organization's partners in the deal, IREO and M3M India, have sketchy histories. Both have been targets of anti-corruption investigations by the Indian government. The investors behind IREO prefer anonymity. The funds for the project provided by IREO arrived via accounts in Mauritius and Cyprus, where their true identities are guarded secrets. The Trump financial empire is truly global, which means that President Trump is vulnerable to financial pressure by foreign entities. If he takes actions as president that are unfavorable to a country, his family estate could suffer. Consider what happened after Trump proposed banning people from entering the United States from 7 predominantly Muslim countries, including Turkey. President Erdogan of Turkey called for Trump's name to be removed from the Trump Tower in Istanbul. Trump's name was not taken off the property, but had it been removed, Trump's licensing fee for that property would have been put at risk. According to financial disclosures, he earns fees of between $1 million and $5 million a year for that property. Ironically, for those who would criticize Trump for anything short of complete divestiture, the fact that he still owns the Trump Organization is exceedingly helpful for transparency. Remember that the adult children of politicians don't need to reveal their financial transactions to the public. So if the Trump Organization were owned by the sons and not the president, ethical watchdogs would have no way of tracking transactions involving the business. Sweetheart deals could be struck with zero accountability, as we have seen repeatedly in previous chapters. But because the President of the United States remains an owner, he will be required to reveal in his annual disclosure any transactions, debts, or assets that he holds. As with Kushner, it is worth looking at the cluster of financial relationships that Trump's sons Eric and Donald Jr. have, and their temptation to seek or accept lucrative deals from foreign or domestic entities looking to curry favor with the Trump administration. In the rough and tumble world of New York City real estate, you can end up doing business with some very sketchy people. For decades, New York real estate has been a popular place for oligarchs, criminals, and shady companies to park their assets. As the New York Times revealed in a series of investigative reports beginning in 2015, foreigners with troubling histories have placed their money in expensive residential and commercial real estate as a means of hiding their assets. Alleged Russian mobsters and politicians, questionable Chinese businessmen, and likely corrupt foreign officials from Kazakhstan, Colombia, Malaysia, Mexico, and more have poured millions into New York real estate through secretive limited liability companies that make it hard to determine who actually owns the properties. Famous New York luxury buildings like the Time Warner Center have become havens for such people. Well before he decided to run for president, Donald Trump and his company conducted business affairs around the world and ended up doing business with numerous individuals with troubling pasts. Take a single project, Trump Soho, a modern, stylish $450 million 46-story hotel condominium on Spring Street in New York. The Trump Organization partnered with a development company called the Bayrock Group, which provided capital for the project. The project was completed in 2010. The Bayrock Group was founded by Tevfik Arif, a Kazakh real estate mogul from the former Soviet Union. In 2010, Arif was arrested in Turkey and charged with running a prostitution ring and engaging in human trafficking. The charges were eventually dropped. Arif had political ties in his home country, including business ties with Viktor Krapunov, a former Kazakh energy minister and former mayor of the city Almaty. Krapunov was allegedly involved in a massive money laundering scheme. As the Financial Times reported, among the dozens of companies the Almaty lawyers say the Krapunov laundering network used were three called Soho 3310, Soho 3322, and Soho 3203. Each was a limited liability company, meaning their ownership could easily be concealed. The companies were created in April 2013 and used to buy apartments that corresponded with their names at Trump Soho. The Financial Times added, on the face of it, Mr. Trump was not a beneficiary of the apartment sales. The vendor was another limited liability company, Bayrock Sapir Organization, LLC. Also involved in the Trump Soho project was another Russian emigre named Felix Sater. Sater emigrated from the Soviet Union to Brooklyn when he was 8. According to Sater, he and his family fled the communist country because of the persecution of Jews. Sater started his career as a stockbroker, but then lost his trading license in 1991 after an incident in a hotel where he stabbed a commodities broker with a margarita glass. He spent a year in prison. He left prison with a wife and child to support and hooked up with a childhood friend who was operating a mafia-linked brokerage firm. Sater pleaded guilty in 1998 to one count of racketeering as part of a $40 million stock fraud scheme. They had been artificially inflating the prices of stock. Sater was connected to the Trump Soho project in that he worked for Bayrock, the Trump partner in the project. Sater reportedly carried around a business card in 2007 in which he listed himself as a senior advisor to Donald Trump. It was the end of January 2017, and three men sat down together at the Lowe's Regency on Park Avenue. Felix Sater, an alleged Russian-American mobster, federal informant, and off-again-on-again Trump business partner, Michael Cohen, President Trump's personal attorney, and Andriy V. Artemenko, a dissident Ukrainian lawmaker. Artemenko had brought a proposed peace plan for his embattled nation, one he claimed enjoyed the blessing of Vladimir Putin via top aides, and he sought to place it before the newly inaugurated president. The meeting had the hallmarks of a back channel around Washington red tape, but Artemenko's choice of intermediaries is troubling. Two of the men had an interesting recent history. On November 3, 2015, Sater emailed Cohen, "Our boy can become president of the USA and we can engineer it. I will get all of Putin's team to buy in on this. I will manage the process." Sater claimed in the same communications to have gotten Ivanka Trump access to Vladimir Putin's private office during a previous Moscow business trip. As reported by the Washington Post and the New York Times, the email was in the context of a nascent and considerable Moscow real estate deal involving the Trump brand. Sater claimed he secured financing from VTB Bank, an entity sanctioned by the U.S. government. A letter of intent had been signed even as Trump's campaign for the highest office in the land gathered steam for the primary season. Permits and other favors were needed in Russia. Sater pitched a Trump visit to Moscow to tout the deal. In return, Putin would publicly praise Trump. According to Sater, the arrangement had a dual and, one might say, huge upside. Trump would be part of an historic real estate deal in the Russian capital. If that weren't enough, the deal would also clear Donald Trump's path to the White House. If he says it, we own this election. As of this writing, no one is saying why Sater was so confident the two outcomes were connected. His price? He indicated his home run would be getting the U.S. ambassadorship to the Bahamas out of the deal. Putin and Trump would find nice things to say about each other during the remainder of the campaign, but the deal went nowhere, petering out in January 2016. No one knows, at this writing, whether the deal provides any context or prologue for the now infamous June 2016 meeting between the Trump campaign and a Russian delegation promising kompromat on Hillary Clinton. Cohen would downplay Sater and his credibility to the Post and the Times, dismissing his talk of a direct pipeline to Putin as salesmanship. New York Magazine reporter Andrew Rice reports Sater and Cohen knew each other as teenagers, perhaps explaining Sater's excitement, expressed to Cohen, "Can you believe two guys from Brooklyn are going to elect a president?" Yet that begs the question. In the face of the failed real estate deal and his failed bravado, why did Cohen accompany Sater to meet with Mr. Artemenko? Who told Mr. Artemenko that these were the men with whom he should speak? The Post and Times reports broke within hours of each other on August 28, 2017. On the third of the same month, Andrew Rice quoted Sater as saying, 30 to 35 days, he told me, I will be the most colorful character you have ever talked about. Unfortunately, I can't talk about it now before it happens. And believe me, it ain't anything as small as whether or not they're going to call me to the Senate committee. As Rice himself says, Sater made the statement to him before news of the June 16, 2016 meeting dropped, so the timelines don't match up. So we will wait and see whether Sater's words are merely his famous salesmanship or something more. Another Bayrock connection was Tamir Sapir, who hailed from Georgia, the country, not the state. Sapir, now deceased, was also an émigré from the Soviet Union, who came to the United States and sold electronics to KGB agents from a storefront in Manhattan. Tamir's son Alex was also involved in the Trump Soho project. Alex Sapir's business partner and brother-in-law is Rotem Rosen, a former right-hand man of the Soviet-born Israeli billionaire Lev Levayev, an oligarch who boasts long-standing ties to Vladimir Putin and counts the Russian president as a true friend. Levayev, who keeps a photo of the Russian president on a shelf in his office, figures into the Trump financial nexus in other ways. When Donald Trump was looking for real estate deals in Moscow, he met with Levayev in 2007 to discuss options. Levayev also sold Jared Kushner a portion of the old New York Times building, located on Times Square in October 2015, after Trump had announced running for president. Mortgages for the Trump Soho building were issued by a Ukrainian businessman named Sam Kislin. Born in Odessa, Ukraine in 1935, he emigrated to the United States in the 1970s. He eventually found his way to Brooklyn, New York, where, with the assistance of Russian emigres, he started an electronics business. His partner in this venture was Tamir Sapir. In 1976, they sold 200 televisions to Trump's Commodore Hotel. He soon began trading with the Soviet Union and established a commodities trading business. But the FBI has claimed that Kislin is a member of the Russian mob. The International Police Organization, or Interpol, in a 1996 report claimed that Kislin's firm, Trans Commodities, was used by two Uzbekistan mobsters for fraud and embezzlement. The Trump Soho deal, among others like it, was done well before Trump ever ran for office. But business relationships can be complicated. They can create alliances that lead to vulnerabilities. Will Trump feel an obligation to any former business partners? Will Trump's sons be in a position to profit off of partners looking for favors from the American president? Trump's business deals have received enormous attention from the press. Some argued that Trump was deeply corrupting the public square even before he took office, and presented a sanitized view of America's recent past. Professor Zephyr Teachout, who has done some very good work on the topic of corruption, bluntly argued, "Trump is upending 240 years of tradition and a core conviction of the founders that a stable, safe, representative republic depends on protecting against the foreign corruption of our office holders." Professor Teachout was no doubt unaware of the foreign corruption of office holders as presented in this book concerning Chinese and Ukrainian commercial deals being done by the son of the vice president, or the commercial ties between Senator McConnell's family and the Chinese government. Teachout is correct in her observation that our constitutional republic is indeed at stake when politicians put family loyalty and estate building before loyalty to the country. Foreign corruption has been a long-time fear of America's leaders, going back to the Founding Fathers. Teachout quotes several founders at length, including Elbridge Gerry, who warned, "Persons having foreign attachments will be sent among us and insinuated into our councils in order to be made instruments for their purposes. Everyone knows the vast sums laid out in Europe for secret services." Foreign commercial entanglements are a problem, but they didn't begin with Trump. Trump brings to office unique skills and complications as a businessman who has amassed properties and companies around the world. Initially, Trump dismissed the notion that the Trump Organization would be an ethical problem. "I was one of those who called on Trump to disconnect himself from his businesses and place his assets in a blind trust." In the piece I co-wrote in the Washington Post with Norm Eisen, Barack Obama's White House ethics czar, I called on Trump to transfer all his business interests to a blind trust or the equivalent. By doing so, he will set an important tone of integrity at the top for everyone in his administration as they address their own ethics and conflicts issues. It was not just a question of Trump doing all he could to separate himself from the family business. Trump's campaign promise to drain the swamp was an important one, and that message, I believe, was a key reason that he won the election. He needs to set a strong ethical example. Some have argued that Trump needed to go further than just separate himself from the business. They argued that he needed to sell his holdings. If he still owned businesses like hotels and foreign diplomats or businesses were paying to use those hotels, he would be violating the U.S. Constitution. This was a reference to the Emoluments Clause, which prevents U.S. officials from receiving payments or things of value from a foreign government or their agents. It is worth noting that this issue never came up when Penny Pritzker was appointed Commerce Secretary. She, of course, would meet the definition of a U.S. official, and she owned commercial real estate properties as well as hotels that did plenty of business with foreign governments and their agents. But more important, many legal scholars disagreed with this interpretation of the Emoluments Clause, arguing that the clause was meant to prevent gifts or bribes. To say that a president could not own a business that has some foreign clients was overly broad. In the end, Trump did not quite set up a blind trust. His team of lawyers set up a trust whereby his children would run the business empire and he would remove himself from any decision-making, but it was not blind. Ethics experts say the scale of his holdings in the United States and around the world and close involvement of his children together mean that the trust wouldn't extricate him from all potential conflicts of interest. Salon writes that Walter M. Schaub, Jr., director of the Office of Government Ethics, in a speech at the Brookings Institution, asserted that Trump stepping back from running his business is meaningless from a conflict of interest perspective, and that limiting direct communication about the business is wholly inadequate. There's not supposed to be any information at all. In my experience, corrupt or questionable transactions can take time to uncover. In Throw Them All Out, I exposed insider trading on the stock market by members of Congress. The book was released in 2011. All of the examples of questionable transactions we uncovered occurred between 2008 and 2010. In Extortion, which was released in 2013, we found, among other things, the extortive fundraising practices of members of Congress. Again, the examples we uncovered had occurred several years earlier. And Clinton Cash, which was released in 2015, was about donations and speaking fees the Clintons received between 2008 and 2012 during her tenure as Secretary of State. In his first 9 months in office, there have been thousands of articles and stories run by major media outlets on the commercial ties involving Trump and his adult children. Some reporting is solid, and some amounts to over-the-top punditry and poor reporting with anonymous sources. Either way, as aggravating as the latter is, the attention is good for the country. It means that people are watching. However, the current level of media attention stands in sharp contrast to the lack of reporting by many of the same news outlets over the previous 8 years on transactions involving Trump's predecessors or senior members on Capitol Hill. This yawning gap is unhealthy. My frustration is not that the solid reporting on Trump has been too tough, but that the reporting on the Obama administration was way too soft, or in some cases non-existent. We can safely assume that if Donald Trump's children struck billion-dollar equity deals with the Chinese government, like Joe Biden's son did, it would make the front page of every newspaper across the country and receive a heavy rotation on the evening news. So where do we go from here? Conclusion. Corruption is not a victimless crime. America needs a Washington Corrupt Practices Act, modeled after the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. The issue of political corruption is not new to our republic, even as it has evolved and changed over the course of the last two centuries. Today, corruption is exponentially more lucrative and complex. It is increasingly hard to enforce ethics standards that hold politicians to the spirit of the law and their sworn duty to serve their country, and not use public office for personal empire building. The mindset that this is just the way the world works is itself corrupt thinking, which denies allegiance to the idea that America is an exceptional nation. If we are to remain an effective constitutional republic, we must face and win the war on corruption at home. We must not tolerate public service as a front for family enrichment and elite will to power. It is un-American and has direct and dire effects on policymaking and good governance. Current ethics laws create a non-accountability zone for the Washington, D.C. political class in general. Let me illustrate this with two recent examples pulled from the headlines. In China, the financial giant J.P. Morgan began a practice of hiring the children of government officials. They did this because they believed that it would enhance their ability to get more business in China. When news of the practice leaked, the federal government charged the company with violating the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, or FCPA. In short, the FCPA says that if you give someone something of value with the hope of getting special treatment from a foreign government, you are committing a corrupt act and can be charged and prosecuted. J.P. Morgan settled with the federal government to the tune of $264 million. Now, imagine if J.P. Morgan had done this not in Shanghai, but in Washington, D.C. Nothing would have happened. It would be and is completely legal. In fact, as we have seen, special deals for the children of American politicians and the practice of hiring the children of politicians to serve as lobbyists is commonplace. Consider another recent corruption case. Governor Bob McDonnell of Virginia and his wife Maureen were given $135,000 in gifts, loans, and trips by a businessman named Johnny Williams Sr. while they occupied the governor's mansion in Richmond. The couple received, among other things, a Rolex watch, shopping trips in New York, and clothes. Williams, who was the CEO of Star Scientific, a producer of dietary supplements, was hoping that the state of Virginia might review his product and vouch for it. McDonnell was charged with public corruption and convicted, but federal courts later overturned the conviction based on existing law. Now imagine if Johnny Williams had given those gifts to a governor in China. Had it been similarly exposed, it would have been a clear violation of the FCPA. The question, then, is why do we have a Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, but not a Washington Corrupt Practices Act? Or, put a different way, why are U.S. lawmakers themselves not held accountable? A Washington Corrupt Practices Act could be based largely on the language in the FCPA. By making it a crime to give gifts, favors, or deals to politicians or their families in the hopes of getting favors in return, we would deal dramatically with the problem of America's princelings. Right now, U.S. law is harsher on corrupt deals involving Chinese princelings than it is on those involving American princelings. That is not a good place for our country to be. Another necessary reform. We need to broaden financial disclosures by American politicians. Transparency is really the best disinfectant. One of the reasons we are seeing the rise of American princelings is because the adult children of American politicians do not have to disclose their financial transactions or assets. I recognize it might seem intrusive to expect the adult children of politicians to disclose publicly exactly what they are earning. After all, they usually do not choose to have parents who hold public office. To strike a balance between disclosure and privacy, the adult children of America's political leaders could at least be required to disclose transactions with foreign entities above, say, $150,000 a year. If they're working for an American corporation on a career track, we don't need to know their salaries, but if they are involved in large financial transactions with foreign entities, we do. Some might argue that this is unfair. But the fact of the matter is that holding public office is a privilege, it is not a right. It comes with unique burdens for oneself and one's family, much as it does for those in military service. The goal of such ethics laws is to protect the Constitution, the pact between the elected and the electorate, that makes us a republic and not an oligarchy. The third necessary reform is to deal with the phenomenon. After the publication of my book, Throw Them All Out, Congress passed and President Obama signed the Stop Trading on Confidential Information, or STOCK Act, which made insider trading illegal for government officials. It was an important reform, which was unfortunately gutted a few months later by the same Congress and President, once the public spotlight moved on to other issues. It is great to have a law that makes insider trading illegal, but it's hard to enforce. The law is easy to legally circumvent. Political intelligence is big business in Washington and basically amounts to the selling of information on what actions the government is going to take that might affect a company. We can tighten the Stock Act to deal explicitly with the smash-and-grab problem. As with corruption in general, smash-and-grab is not a victimless crime. Smashing a company throws thousands of people out of work and disrupts the lives of many, so that someone else can grab and profit. Only by changing existing laws can we deter this kind of grossly unethical behavior. Finally, a word must be said to politicians themselves. Unfortunately, many politicians in Washington believe they are entitled to on-the-job enrichment and building family empires at our expense. Some in the nation's capital want to do the right thing. They must make clear to their children that they will be offered sweetheart deals and that they must not take them. Back in May 1988, then-Vice President George H.W. Bush was running for president. He sent a letter to his eldest son, George W. Bush. "We are about to sail into uncharted waters, in terms of family scrutiny," he wrote. "We've all been through a lot of inquiry and microscopic probing. However, it'll get worse, not just for our family." Father advised son, "As we move closer to November, you'll find you've got a lot of new friends. They may become real friends. My plea is this. Please do not contact any federal agency or department on anything. A call from a Bush will get returned, but there is a great likelihood that it will be leaked, maybe deliberately misrepresented." Ethical reputation is a legacy worth passing along to one's own children and one's country. This is Charles Constant. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Secret Empires by Peter Schweitzer. This program was produced by B Audio. Executive producer, Katie Ostroka. Text copyright 2018 by Peter Schweitzer. Production copyright 2018 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.